degrees in Racine, 66 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very, very honored indeed to be able to spend today's morning show talking with two Milwaukee-based activists, labor activists, and activists who have especially worked hard on behalf of working women, Ellen Bravo and Larry Miller. Larry, I think, calls them co-conspirators. And says they have been co-conspirators now for going on 5 decades. And Ellen Bravo is also responsible for several previous books, including one published not long ago called Taking on the Big Boys, and previously a novel called Again and Again, published some years ago. The two of them have collaborated on a new work of fiction, but is very much based on reality, and very much based on many of the experiences that they have had in their work as activists. The book is titled Standing Up, Tales of Struggle. It's actually a series of short stories, but there is certainly a connective through line of a similar sort of activist spirit and a sense of working hard on behalf of those who perhaps have no voice or diminished voice in terms of being able to better their own situations. And this is work which Ellen Bravo and Larry Miller are very, very deeply acquainted with themselves. Ellen Bravo in particular is well known as the co-founder of the Milwaukee chapter of 9to5, the National Association of Working Women. And the two of them have worked incredibly hard on a number of different important issues. And I'm so pleased that we can have the next few minutes to talk about their work and to talk about this new book, again titled Standing Up, Tales of Struggle. Ellen Bravo and Larry Miller, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Larry Miller, I actually want to direct the first question to you, that matter that I mentioned briefly in the introduction about you and your wife being co-conspirators. What led you to choose that interesting term to describe your partnership?
Well, as individuals, we've done a lot of our own work. I was a factory worker for over 20 years, and then I went back to school and became a teacher here in Milwaukee. And all it, so I was working within the teachers union. Before that, I had worked in a number of unions. And while all of that was going on, Ellen was organizing among women, low-wage women, secretaries, all sorts of things. So our work complemented each other, but the main thing is that we're very supportive of each other's work. And that's at the heart of us being co-conspirators. We've, over the years, had many discussions over the over dinner, over what did you do today? It was always complex and very interesting.
It wasn't going to the hairdresser or playing a round of golf. It was
one of the things that that we've both known for a long time is that these struggles are linked, that the people who oppress women are the same people who are responsible for racism and for the exploitation of workers, for wars and of aggression in foreign countries. And so we, you know, we've seen ourselves as part of the same struggle, even when the target of what we were doing was very different.
Right, or if you were working in different arenas. I'd be really interested to know a little bit about the background of each of you, that is where you are from originally, and in particular, in terms of your early life, if we can trace anything from that to who you are today as hardworking activists. Who wants to begin?
So I was born in Baraboo, Wisconsin, and grew up in Middleton, Wisconsin, just outside Madison. My parents had met at the Badger Munitions Works, just south of Baraboo during World War II, working in the factory there. And I grew up with parents that were part of that new generation coming out of World War II that believed that everybody should be treated fairly and equally. And so they became aware of Reverend King organizing, they were very supportive of him. And so our household, a very Christian household, really did believe in equality. So I grew up with that in the 50s and 60s. I grew up in that atmosphere, and it led me to wanting to actually become an organizer, which the book talks about some with it in the first chapter, which pretty closely was true. It depicts a wildcat strike that happened in the laundry at Grady Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia.
Right. Yeah.
And I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, in a Jewish family. When you grow up right after the war, the Holocaust isn't something you learn about someday in school or Sunday school. It was something people talked about all the time. You just knew it. And so the concept of how did that happen and how were so many people silent, and the importance of taking a stand against injustice, was something I learned at a very young age. I also lived in a community that had covenants against Black families moving in that was being fought when I was in school. And it was really clear who was on which side of that fight. I feel like one of the things Larry and I would say, rather than, we really like the term that Mbolo Mbue use about the deliberately unheard. For us, working people all have a voice. They don't have a megaphone. And the people who control the megaphone drown out their voices. And we also believe strongly in being part of vehicles, organizations that engage people who are most impacted by the problem, so that they can not only tell their stories, but help decide strategy. And creating organizations that provide enough support and activities that are possible for people who have families, no time, and no money is really key to the success of winning and reaching the justice in the world we deserve.
How did the two of you meet?
Well, we were both living in Baltimore. I was working at Sparrows Point, which was at that time the largest steel mill in the country, single steel mill, not as large as the Gary Works. But I was working there, and Ellen was working at Baltimore General Hospital. And the Dump Nixon movement evolved. Was developing and evolving, and so there were large meetings. The Central Labor Council and a number of organizations had called for removing Nixon from office. So we eyed each other, listened to each other at these Dump Nixon meetings in Baltimore.
And chapter 5 in the book, called "I'm Paying for My Dinner," is a pretty accurate account of our first date, even though the backstory of Sophie, so the character inspired by me is Sophie, and the character inspired by Larry is Nick. There's several chapters in the beginning about Nick, a young white working class kid from Wisconsin who goes south to try to be in the heart of the struggle and really learn from Black workers. And then he meets Sophie, and then there's several chapters about Sophie's organizing, and then on and on. So everything except Sophie's backstory in that chapter is pretty accurate about our first date.
I like that. And I'm excited to talk with you about your choice to write a work of fiction that is such a close reflection of who you are in real life. Before we get to the book, I want to ask you one other kind of overarching background question. I think when we picture two, again, as Larry said, co-conspirators, two fiery, hardworking activists living under the same roof, I think one picture we maybe have is of each of you kind of egging the other on, urging the other on, you know, go, go, go. Another picture would be of one of you maybe being the one who gets the other to reflect on what they're about to do. I mean, maybe reins them in a little bit, gets them to stop and consider, you know, the consequences. Or, you know what I mean? There's like two very different scenarios that kind of pop into one's head in terms of what your life is like together as activists who care about the same issues and in at least many respects work together on those issues. How would you characterize the nature of your partnership or your relationship as activists, and what effect do you have on each other in that work?
So I think Larry put his finger on it before when he said that we're really supportive of each other. I would describe our relationship more as having each other's back and being in each other's heads and knowing when, if one of us gets dispirited or is in the midst of a lot of conflict, how to show up for each other, help each other think through what we're doing, but also celebrate the joy of winning and the wonder of the people that we're in struggle with and be present in their lives. And also we've co-parented. We have two great kids, two grown sons, and that was something we did very much together, sharing both the responsibilities but also the joys.
That really captures it. One of the things for me, Ellen would often act as a teaching me restraint in my reaction to people and things. You know, it's so easy to go off the handle, or you know, to over criticize other folks. When you know, when you're organizing, doing this stuff, you have to have incredible amount of restraint, or you'll just alienate everybody. And so she was very over the years has been very helpful, very helpful.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Ellen Bravo and Larry Miller, who are both Milwaukee-based activists and husband and wife. And in addition to their partnership as activists, they are also co-authors of a book that's just been published called Standing Up, Tales of Struggle. This is actually a work of fiction. It's actually a series of short stories, and these short stories cross decades of time, actually. Beginning, I think, in the very early 1970s into the early 21st century. And they involve activists working very, very hard on a variety of issues, many of them deeply interrelated. So the question that really comes to mind is, why a work of fiction? What did you find attractive about the possibility of crafting a work that would be fictional, and yet would somehow be a reflection of the work you do and the issues you care about?
Two things mainly. One is you can fill in things that you don't remember exactly word for word, conversations, interactions with people, dates. And the other is you can bring in other voices of, so the stories begin, as I said, with Nick, and then stories about Sophie where Nick is involved. But then there are people they meet along the way and they become central characters. So there's a series of stories about a stand-up of people who work in the call center of an airline making reservations in the early days of this call may be monitored for quality purposes. And there's a story about a woman who left an abusive husband inspired by that being part of that struggle. And then he took her kids and what did, how she got them back and what that meant. And then a series of stories about the daughter of that woman who grew up thinking that she could get in a position of power in a bank and help make change, and didn't realize what changes she'd have to go through in order to get that position and how oppressive that might be to other people. So it gave us an opportunity to broaden out the scope and then come back always to Sophie and Nick. And so there's a story of Nick and his students, whose students were taking on environmental racism, a story of Sophie and one of her close friends doing sexual harassment training of firefighters, and then a story I really needed to tell called The Roar of the Elders, about how to deal with all the bias there is about people as they get older, and the trivialization and demeaning of older people, and how to challenge it.
I think one of the best things about the book is the fact that it spans the time that it does, because I suppose that's also a really healthy reflection of the nature of the work that you've done, the particular issues that have risen in importance over the years. I mean, what you are doing now is not exactly the same thing as what you were doing 50 years ago, although it might maybe feel the same and maybe springs from the same heart, but this is a story that has evolved in a lot of fascinating ways, and it seems like you were anxious for your book to reflect that.
Absolutely. It's just, in covering 50 years, there's so much history there. So it was, we had to figure out what would we keep, what would we leave, you know, what would we not reflect on? And so we picked the different stories that evolved. For example, when the hospital strike happened at the beginning of the book, and it was in 69, one of the interesting things that was going on right after that, and we brought into the story, the next story, which was at Grinnell Steel, one of the most horrific working condition foundries you could ever imagine. In the background of it was there were strikes by Black workers against discrimination all over Atlanta, in small shops at the Mead Corporation, which did all the does all the packaging for Coca-Cola products, and so there was incredible historic things going on in the background, and I had a chance to participate in something that was, you know, a very minor part, but something that was very, to me, very historic. And so we tried to capture that in different parts of it. Of course, we were part of the resistance against the war in Vietnam, and we reflect that in one of the stories. So there's many parts of the movements that were going on through those 50 years that we talk about.
And it's interesting because a story that takes place in the mid 80s. Called Should Banks Care About Kids? That is a reflective of something that happened, and it's pretty accurate about exactly the way it got started, got organized, and got resolved. It references a sexual harassment incident at a time when there was very little recourse for people who were being discriminated against. I mean, there were things they could do, but it was a much harder time. And then near the end of the book, you have the chapter about training the firefighters, where there's, you know, a union publicly taking a stand about the need for its members to think not only about defending those who are accused of harassment, but also those who are undergoing it, and how much it divides workers and needs to be stopped, and what it means to step up, not just to not be a harasser, but to not be a bystander, not let it happen.
Right. As I read the first chapter, which describes an organized slowdown that occurs at Brady Hospital's laundry room, and we'll have you talk about this in a little bit, it reminded me of an interview I was really privileged to record a few years ago with one of the most famous activists from the 1960s and early 70s, Todd Gitlin. And I got to interview him about his book, Letter to a Young Activist. And I remember in that interview, we spent a little time to kind of talking about what is an activist versus what is an organizer. And of course, what I had never stopped to really think about, and I think most people don't, is that the word organizer is so important because it really does involve organizing something. I mean, like putting something carefully into order, whatever sort of plan it might be, some plan of action, some systematic response to a wrongdoing or whatever. But you can't, as you were saying earlier, just fly off the handle or just sort of express your rage and frustration kind of madly, but that it is about being organized and meticulous, and that sometimes that can be at odds with the kind of visceral anger that one might feel over an injustice. Can you just talk a moment about that balancing act between, let's call it, righteous anger versus the need to be organized and meticulous and careful and cautious, all those things that would seem to sort of fly in the face of that?
Well, I think especially if you're committed to and understand the importance of having the people who are most impacted lead and be involved in the planning, you realize that while you may be able to take the risk of, okay, I can get fired, I'll go find another job, a lot of people can't. And you may be able to get arrested. Not everybody can. So it means thinking carefully about what engages people, what helps them say, what's happening to us is not just wrong, it's not inevitable, and it can be changed. And we are the ones who can change it, not by ourselves, but by all of us acting together. And that means thinking through step by step what it will take to get to the win. So several of the stories in the book really try to show that process of what it means to organize, but always workers are at the forefront of that process. Hmm.
I really enjoyed this first chapter, which, as I said, involves some really terrible working conditions at the Grady Hospital laundry room. And so this young sort of rising activist named Nick, based, I guess, on Larry's life, helps to organize a secret slowdown. And I don't think we hear about this much anymore, but once upon a time, of course, this was a tried and true practice to try to gain some attention and point the spotlight on something that needed to be changed. Larry Miller, describe what such a slowdown is designed to accomplish and what's involved in doing it in the best way.
So the you have to figure out the conditions at where you work. I mean, it's a little bit different than being a teacher. You know, you can't slow down with your children, with your students. But when you're working in certain service industries or in factories, it's possible. And so what we met as a group, the whole laundry was, we were 100% united. I was the only white worker, and they had hired me to get some experience and then advance me to be one of the white bosses. And they found out very quickly that their plan wasn't going to work. So we were meeting at a restaurant not too far from the laundry, and we decided that we had put forward many conditions that we wanted change, and they never got back to us, never responded. So we said we needed to take action. And what's interesting, in a hospital, it used to be the largest hospital in Georgia. I don't know, it probably still is, still in full operation. It has these laundry chutes that come from all floors, you know, from the top of the building to the bottom of the building. People put laundry in those chutes, and there were, I believe, three on each side of the hospital, maybe more. And they're very large, and they put the laundry in, and it drops all the way to the basement. And then you pick it up there, and we'd put it on a truck and drive directly across the street in a large truck with the laundry, because there was so much laundry. So when we slowed down, we just didn't pick up the laundry in the basement quickly. And the laundry started piling. You couldn't see us slowing down, because every time the bosses would come to observe us, we'd be working full speed, but the people on the other side of the hospital would be working very slowly, and the laundry kept building up, and it got seen on the first floor, second floor. So they open up the doors and they can't, there's nowhere to put the laundry because it's packed in and it kept going up and up. They'd come and observe us and we'd be working. And so it was very powerful.
One of the things you mentioned in that chapter is that you had to develop a system of secret alerts. So exactly what you described would happen. That is, when the bosses were showing up, then the pace of work would pick up again to its normal pace. Describe what kind of alerts we're talking about.
Well, back then, you know, you didn't have cell phones, and there were different workers that there was. The people taking the laundry out of the chutes and putting them in carts to wheel back to the corner of the house, to the basement, to load them on the truck. So one person would be pulling them out of the chutes and putting them in the carts. Another person would be taking the carts and then putting them and loading them in the truck. So the way to do it was that person going back and forth to the truck was the key person that alerted everybody. And then as soon as the truck was moved over to the laundry, it was always guys, one of the guys, there were seven guys and about 40 women. He would alert the women of what was going on because they wanted to know exactly what was happening, even if they weren't directly involved at that point.
What is so great is the way women would pass the word among each other. And, you know, that chapter and also the chapter called The Union Makes Us Strong reminded me a lot about when the Amazon workers in Staten Island who won their union election, the way they organized was a similar thing. And it meant paying attention to who the other workers were, finding ways to go talk to them if you, because it was really hard always to do it at work. Finding in you know, places to go, like Larry said, this restaurant nearby, making sure that everyone was who needed to be was in on the details, providing food, taking down the company's materials, disrupting the message that the boss was trying to give and the division they were trying to sow, like in the case of Nick trying to get him to say, well, you're white, you should be with us. Instead, Nick went right to the workers and told them what had happened. So those kinds of being in touch with each other and thinking really strategically about what would be most effective.
Another component of what we did in the laundry was if anybody was fired, we would all stop working. We had already agreed to that, which is a big step because most of the workers there had come up from Southern, from Alabama and Southern Georgia to get jobs in the city. And these are the only jobs that they could get, particularly as women, only jobs that they could get at that time. So they were putting a lot on the line, but we had agreed. So they really harassed this young guy that they had recently hired. And he started yelling at them and then they fired him. It was all intentional, but we were prepared for at any we felt we were anyway, any step that they were going to take.
What was the ultimate benefit of these actions that you took? I mean, what kind of changes were enacted there?
Oh, they, management higher up, when it got to them, they wanted to be very soon getting the equipment that we needed, face masks, gloves, all of those things. And then we set up a committee. AFSCME was the union, but AFSCME, it's a right to work state. AFSCME wasn't directly involved. We decided to do this. They had invited me to be the assistant. There were two shop stewards. They invited me to be assistant shop steward. So there were three of us, one man, one woman, and myself. And we started setting up regular meetings, giving saying what we wanted. And one of the demands of the workers, what they wanted, black management. They wanted them to hire African-American management, which they did. So I felt it was total victory. Really was total victory. I mean, it took time to get it in place and to work it out, but it was total victory.
And I like the way this chapter ends with these words. The next day, everybody quickly got to work. No one talked a lot as they performed their tasks, but everyone now and then You could hear whistling. Athalia kept up a steady hum. "It's like everyone was a little lighter," Nick told Sam that night when they finally caught up. "That's pride, man," Sam said. "Burns up so much less energy than rage."
Exactly.
We're speaking with Ellen Bravo and Larry Miller about the book that they have co-authored called Standing Up, Tales of Struggle. It's a work of fiction, a series of short stories, but these are at least a fairly close reflection of much of the work that they have done as activists over the course of many decades. They now live and work in Milwaukee. Larry Miller, I want to be sure I also ask you about the second story, which is called The Rockefeller Eight, which really refers to something a whole lot different than just a work slowdown. Explain who the Rockefeller Eight were and what their cause was.
Well, Rockefeller was David Rockefeller was coming to town as a guest of the Chamber of Commerce, and it was in the midst of a lot of demonstrations going on about the war in Vietnam. And so we decided that, and so there was going to be a large demonstration organized by the mobilization, mobilization against the war, which was a very large, coalition across the country when he came. But we, a group of us said, we need to be more militant and we need to disrupt the dinner of the Chamber of Commerce. And so we chose to do that, and we all got arrested and sent to the City Farm Prison. And so that chapter talks about the experience, and it was very, very interesting. And having had experience with cows, you know, with my family, huge numbers of my family are farmers. I ended up in a section of the prison farm taking care of the cows, which is actually the best place to work because you only milk in the morning and milk at night. And I took a couple of the guys with me, but the other guys that got arrested, they worked in the fields from sunup till sundown. And so it was pretty interesting. And interacting with the prisoners, I mean, these were workers that were in prison, none of them for serious crimes. It was, in general, mostly not for serious crimes, you know, for public alcoholism and stuff like that. And it was just, it was very educational, very educational.
One of the things we wanted to point out also, though, was the eye-opening experience for these white young guys, meeting black guys who'd been in that prison for a very long time because they couldn't get a court date and didn't have money for bail. Wow. And the other prisoners knew that these white kids were going to get out soon. And it really opened their eyes to the situation of incarceration as a, new form of slavery and or a different form of enslavement, and the absolute class and race restraints on people, and the need for all of us to see the solidarity that's needed, and not make this allow those in power to describe as using words like evil or violent people when so many of them are really just living in poverty.
The third chapter of your book, Down Yonder Against the Wall, talks about the horrific conditions at a company called Grinnell Steel. And Larry, I think you talked at some point earlier in the interview about maybe it was that you worked someplace yourself that was a steel plant with really terrible conditions.
I worked at Grinnell Steel. It was a foundry and it's kind of a famous place. It's now a gentrified restaurants where the steel mill was. But the reason I really wanted that chapter, it's a very important chapter to me because, again, I go into the shop and there's a union, but it's a very racist union. And the I was put in the department It was all black. The only whites in the department were the managers. Now, there were white workers, but they had the cleaner, better paying jobs on the docks, for example. So there was it was a form of segregation. So we wanted to be able to talk about those kinds of both the working conditions, but also the amazing relationships I had with the workers that I was working with. I mean, there was in one department, I'd go between departments, but in one department, the card room, they made good money, but you couldn't work any harder or more in a more difficult situation than these workers. But they were on incentive, and so they made good money. And one of the things I came to find out is that most of them had been in prison, and this was the only job that they could get, making good money. But then the amount of work was just ridiculous, the level of work that they did.
When, of course, just in terms of the kind of air that people are breathing in and the coughing you would hear throughout this facility and so on, I mean, it's the kind of conditions in which no human being should be forced to work, should be forced to endure. I wanted to ask you about a striking line that comes towards the end of this chapter, in which Nick, which I guess means you, is kind of reflecting on some of the lessons that you'd learned, the gift of, among other things, patience, some insights you'd gained on what real strength was, real leadership. And then you say, above all, he was learning that organizing had to be based on friendship and love. Organizing had to be based on friendship and love. I think a lot of people who are on the outside looking in would never guess that that was the key. So in what way is that true? How has that been true in the work that the two of you have done, for instance?
Well, you really have to love the workers. I mean, the workers are the backbone of this country. Historically, they created this country, whether it was slave labor or labor in the Southwest or in the factories or in the fields. These are the people that make this country, and these are the people that Ellen and I are proud to be connected to and love. And when you go into organizing, you have to build trust. Trust is at the heart of it. And you have to become friends and want to become friends with these amazing people whose lives on a daily level are struggling to survive. And it's just the one word that should be added to that is trust.
I think the thing we've also trying to say is that there's no shortcut, that the organizing is means taking the time. Sorry about that. Organizing means taking the time to really get to know people. And as Larry said, build trust and relationships. But also it's about joy that, you know, people think of other people talk about sacrifice and you work tirelessly and they don't think about the community that you build and the joy of stepping into power, the joy of small victories, the joy of recognizing, even if you don't get there now, that we will get there, and of reclaiming our own language and our own way of describing what's happening and picturing the world that we need and the world we deserve.
That's why the work that's the victory that happened at Amazon in Staten Island is so important, because one of the things that people in work all across the country are paying attention. And then you have a lot of even small workplaces like Starbucks that are organizing and taking advantage of the thinking that's going on. And face it, a lot of millennials haven't had union experience. And now is the time for them to wake up and to see that this has to be part of their future.
And Ellen Bravo, I want to give you a chance to talk about the wide array of issues that are taken up with working women, and in particular, the work that you did beginning in the early 1980s What were the most pressing concerns, and how did you want those conveyed in your book, Standing Up, Tales of a Struggle?
Well, the most pressing concerns are still concerns for millions of people. The lack of flexibility for caregiving. The concerns then are the same, you know, many of them are the same concerns now for millions of women. Lack of flexibility for caregiving. The prevalence of horrific treatment, including sexual harassment, sexual assault, lack of fair pay, and demeaning treatment. And the great thing that's happened over the last 50 years, we've made a lot of progress. I'll give you an example. In when this time in the book started, sexual harassment didn't even have a name. And even though there was a law that could have been used, it wasn't, to say that sexual harassment is a form of gender discrimination. People didn't know who to tell, and most of them didn't tell anybody. And since then, that's changed a lot. There's a name, there's a law, there's a movement. And recently, Me Too and Time's Up have been very high profile in taking down some folks and making it much harder for people to get away with it. On the other hand, we have two members of the Supreme Court of the United States of America who are sexual harassers. And we had a president who was a sexual predator until very recently, it was in office. And we have a Supreme, that new Supreme Court is on the verge of taking away rights to reproductive freedom. So we have a lot of work to do, but we have organization, messaging, insight, willing people engaged to try to turn it around. I think what a lot of us need is more of a long-term view and realizing when there are setbacks that this has happened before and we will be able to prevail. We did stop a coup. We did win that election. We can stop again in this November and in 24 and in the future. And we need to hold on to that sense of power and then be really smart about the forms of struggle we take on.
I want to ask you about a couple more striking lines in your book, Standing Up, Tales of Struggle. One of them is in the chapter called Should Banks Care About Kids, in which Sophie, after talking with a worker there named Rosa, said she was grateful Rosa had not assumed there was some law that automatically protected you for telling the truth about your employer. It clawed at her insides when people confused what should exist with what did. And I'm sure that really is, you know, kind of a painful moment when you have to tell somebody who kind of blithely or naively assumes that there are safeguards in place that make all the sense in the world that, no, sometimes those safeguards do not exist. And when you are going to be stepping out, you have to do so courageously at tremendous risk.
Exactly. The other thing, though, that Rosa learned in that chapter is that organizing doesn't mean getting everybody to immediately sign on. It means starting with the people you know the best and you trust the most, and making a strategy that is going to be practical, that they all can do, and that when they do it, they will see some result, and that there are other people who will support them, and that what's at stake for them, there's a reason why everybody cares, and that is that it's happening everywhere. It's not unusual. It's not just their workplace, and that if they stand up against it, many people will hear them.
The other line I wanted to be sure to ask you about comes in the chapter, which is called The Union Makes Us Strong, and one of several chapters in which you kind of outline for us the hard work that is involved in getting a union established in a given place of employment. And it is one of the characters involved in this story who says at one point, in the long run, the best way to get anything for yourself is to get it for everyone. I suppose that's probably one of the abiding themes of the work that both of you have done over the course of your lives.
Exactly. And, you know, there's one of the workers in there also says, you don't always win when you stand up for yourself, but you never win when you don't. And I think those recognitions, those two things of it matters, we can make a difference. And that there, when people say it's all about, if you just believe in yourself, you can be whatever you want, that we have to realize there's a reason why that's not true. And it's not for our own lack of trying or of capacity. It's that there are barriers that have to be removed and that we are the ones to remove them. And so the best way to do what will in the long run be what you need is to make sure that there's collective action to change the policies and get rid of those barriers, make systemic change.
Well, the book is wide ranging, even beyond all that we have already talked about today. And anybody intrigued is encouraged to seek it out. Again, it's titled Standing Up, Tales of Struggle. It is published by Hardball Press. And I know you are making some bookstore appearances, including one in Portland, Oregon. That's, of course, not anywhere near Wisconsin, but through the wonders of technology, people can be part of that event virtually if they want to hear more from you and learn even more about this interesting book.
If people go to our website, ellenbravo.com, there'll be an events page. And if you're interested in joining a virtual event, there's a way you'll be able to sign up.
Very good. EllenBravo.com. And Ellen Bravo and Larry Miller are the co-authors of this really interesting book called Standing Up, Tales of Struggle, a collection of intriguing and illuminating short stories, the book published by Hardball Press. Ellen Bravo, Larry Miller, I've really enjoyed speaking with both of you, and I very much enjoyed reading your book. It was inspiring, and I thank you for being part of the morning show today. Very best wishes to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Our pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Tomorrow on the morning show, something of a red letter day. It will be once again the monthly visit of Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College. And tomorrow, he's going to be joined by his two counterparts, Dr. Deborah Ford, who is the chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and Dr. John Swallow, who is the president of Carthage College. As many of you know, Brian Albrecht recently announced his retirement from the presidency of Gateway, and very likely this will be the last opportunity that we will have the three of them together in our WGTD studios to talk about their respective schools and the challenges they face, and also the rich legacy of deep cooperation between these three institutions of higher learning. So tomorrow should be a very exciting and meaningful conversation. We hope that you'll make a point of joining us tomorrow. For President Brian Albrecht, President John Swallow, and Chancellor Deborah Ford. And Thursday's morning show, we will be previewing this weekend's concert of the Racine Symphony Orchestra with conductor Pascal Lorino. And we'll also be talking with concert pianist David Fung, who is coming to town to play Tchaikovsky's magnificent Piano Concerto No. 1. And we'll have conversations with both of these gentlemen on Thursday's morning show. And on Friday, the music continues as I speak with one of the most renowned conductors in the world and a prolific recording artist as well, conductor John Malcheri. He has written a very provocative new book called The War on Music, Reclaiming the 20th Century. It is Maestro Marcheri's contention that most of the symphonies of the world have done themselves and the public a grave disservice by ignoring
so much wonderful and fully accessible music from the 20th century, in particular, the great music written for film. And he explores all that and the reasons behind it in his new book, which we talked